constructed and faced up to, and otherwise there will be no social change that's meaningful for anyone.
Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, thank you so much for joining us, Indigenous historian and activist. That does it for today's show. Tune in tomorrow for our Standing Rock special. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron, Hani Masood, Charina Nadura, and Andre Lewis. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Renee Feltz, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godars, Anthony Manzo, and Karl Marxer. Thank you so much. I'm Nermeen Sheikh, sitting in for Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
KBOO Community Radio is currently hiring for the following three positions: Station Manager, Evening News and Public Affairs Director, and Director of Underwriting. To apply to one of these positions, send a cover letter and resume to hiring@kboo.org, or bring or mail your resume with cover letter to 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please answer the following question: why is KBOO important? Open until filled. Interviews will begin around December 9th. No phone calls, please. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. For more information, go to kboo.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Aftermath, part of the Brown Paper series produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs November 28th at 7 p.m. at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. In Mary Burrell's 1919 one-act, John Thornton, a young black soldier who has served his country in World War I, comes home to rural South Carolina. His homecoming is disrupted when he learns that someone close to him has been lynched by a white mob. Again, that's Aftermath, produced by Triangle Productions, November 28th at 7 p.m. at The Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, this is KBOO Portland. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Little Boxes, hosting a citywide shopping event with over 200 small and independent businesses in Portland, happening on the Friday and Saturday after Thanksgiving. Full list of shops at shoplittleboxes.com or on the Little Boxes apps for iPhone and Android. And now stay tuned for Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland and Jacqueline Keeler.
And the rivers and the oceans and the streams are muddy brown, and the red and orange sunset turns to gray, and the sunlight gets dimmer as the haze falls all around, and the green and yellow hills have turned to clay. In a world without tomorrow, in a world that cannot last, in a world without tomorrow, my friend, that day is on its way. My friend, that day is coming fast. And the flowers, they are dying as a black rain takes its toll, and all the fish are turning gray and pale, and the blue and purple mountains look like a pile of coal, and the atmosphere is getting thick and stale. In a world without tomorrow, in a world that cannot last, in a world without tomorrow, my friend, that day on its way. My friend, that day is coming fast. Mm-hmm.
friend, that day is on its way. My friend, that day is coming fast. And the trees are dead and buried.
And good morning. This is KBOO Community Radio, Wednesday Talk Radio. My name's Paul Roland, and I do have my co-host for this program on the phone. She's on her way out of town, so she wasn't able to join us in the studio, Jacqueline Keeler. I just wanted to first say that was Floyd Westerman, the late, great Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate, Eastern Dakota singer-songwriter, American Indian Movement, International Indian Treaty Council, troubadour, left us in 2007. What I said I was going to talk about, a united front, I must first, to all of you people who know a lot more about history and politics than I do, maybe I shouldn't even be doing the show if I'm going to make such egregious errors. I said, so what could a united front against accelerated corporate elite domination look like? And with Standing Rock as an example, the need for an indigenous-led movement is more necessary and urgent than ever. We'll be talking about those things. But so united front, I actually meant popular front. And again, I sincerely apologize to those of you who know this stuff. And anyway, so a popular front is what I meant, is a broad coalition of different political groupings, usually made up of leftists and centrists. Being very broad, they can sometimes include centrist and liberal or bourgeois forces, as well as social democratic and communist groups. Popular fronts are larger in scope than united fronts, which were more like something sort of gerrymandered in some sense by communist groupings. But of course, these things are, have their time in history and may not even apply to the present. Maybe they had such contradictions within themselves. But the reason I brought that up is because everybody's talking about the possibility that Trumpism, or whatever you want to call it, is something like emerging fascism. And I've heard it talked about here on KBOO. I've heard it talked about elsewhere. Obviously, things are changing in ways that are very unsettling for people, and we need to come to grips with what the phenomenon is and how best to respond to it, I guess. Is that right? So let's bring up Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning.
I don't know what you thought of all that, but so mainly what we wanted to talk about was, as I mentioned, with Standing Rock as an example for possibly indigenous-led whatever it might emerge. And so we wanted to talk first about what's been happening. We just heard briefly on Democracy Now. It seems it's just incredible what this the extent, the lengths to which the state of North Dakota is going to beat down this opposition to the pipeline.
Yeah, I would say so. I would say at this point, North Dakota is a failed state. It's a rogue state, utilizing, it's become an authoritarian regime, utilizing to restrict human rights and use, terrorism and heavy weaponry to assert its needs and wants over the Standing Rock Sioux Nation and the Ocheti Jacqueline Oyate, the entire Great Sioux Nation and their allies. And we have to remember this is a pipeline that Bismarck itself, the city of Bismarck and where the governor lived, did not want north of its water intake source on the river, but is trying to force the Standing Rock, the people of Standing Rock and all the people downriver to accept. And I was watching the press conference last week, and the governor's all like, this is state-of-the-art technology, and this pipeline is so fantastic. And it's just like, well, why don't you want it north of where you live, where your water comes from? And it's obvious why, because they just feel like that the people of Standing Rock, the Great Sioux Nation, is disposable, is not an important place, so I think that the use of violence is just, and as a Native person, as a Dakota woman, and I should say that my tribe, the Yankton Dakota Sioux, are actually suing the Army Corps of Engineers over JAPL. We are also signees of the 1851 Treaty of Fort Laramie, which includes the area north between Bismarck and the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation northern border. All of that land is unceded treaty territory, which means that our nation, the Great Sioux Nation, the Iocheti Shakuin Oyate, never actually gave that land up in any formal manner. It's simply occupied by military force by the U.S. government and by the state of North Dakota.
So let's get into that just a little more, because, this is something that we hear, but maybe it hasn't been fully explained. So what are the different stratagems that have been used to take land unilaterally from indigenous nations and, remove bits at a time, large bits at a time, and reduce the original many, many, many of the reservations that were created out of, original homelands or away from the original homelands? They were already reduced from, what people originally lived in, gathered, fished, hunted, whatever people did. And then after that, subsequently, pieces have been continually taken. That's what happened to the Osete Sakoyan Nation, right?
Yeah, the Great Sioux Nation, which in our, Sioux is a name that was given to us by the Americans because they had met, or I guess also by the French, because they had met the Ojibwe, our ancient enemies, the Ojibwe, or they call them the Ojibwe, Chippewa, and Anishinaabe, who were pretty vicious enemies of ours to the east, who had driven us out of the Great Lakes region using French guns. And they called us Sioux, which is in their language, I guess, a term for snakes. And so our word for ourselves, for ourselves as people, are Dakota, Lakota, which means allies. And then our word for our nation is the Ocheti Shakowin, which means the seven council fires. And those include seven. Seven and four are numbers that are very, occur a lot in our culture and are also sacred. And so we often organize ourselves in groups of seven. And so these seven council fires include the Tetuan, which are the Lakota, which they have seven subgroups, which include the Ogallala, which is Crazy Horse people, and the Hunkpapa, which are Sitting Bulls people who are at Standing Rock. And then the other six, which are two of which are include Yihanktawan, which is my group, and then the Yihanktawana, which many of them are at Standing Rock. That's where the reservation they were put on. And then the other four are Dakota, which are like Mittawankaton and all those groups. And so that is our nation. The Ocheti Shakowin is our nation. It's the Americans call the Great Sioux Nation. And this is the first time since the Battle of the Little Bighorn that all seven council fires have camped together. And that is why the camp is called the Ocheti Shakowin Camp. And one of my family members is on the Elders Council there as the representative from the Yihanktawan, from the Yanktons. I think that I often refer to the United States as a colony without portfolio, meaning that it is a colony which without a homeland. It doesn't actually have a homeland. Its lands are composed of lands that it has taken and cobbled together from other people's homelands, and has cut itself off from its original homeland during the Revolutionary War from Great Britain. And the purpose of a colony is structural and intrinsic. The purpose of a colony is to extract wealth from another group, from another country, at a massive rate, with no concern for the people of that country or that land, and to send that wealth back home to the top 1% of the homeland. and of the empire. And so this is really still how the United States works. You know, I think we had a little moment there where after World War II and a great many Americans got to enjoy in the wealth of being part of a colony. But for the majority of time, the United States is this colony has existed for the purpose of extracting wealth from this land, from our land, for just the top 1% of the colony. But, and it's continuing to do that again, as you can see with North Dakota's complete support of oil companies, and this one run out of Texas by CEO Kelsey Warren, Energy Transfer Partners, which is now merged with Sunoco. On the same day, basically, it was announced the day after they had Sunday night, they had attacked all those water protectors in the middle of the night in North Dakota in freezing, sub-freezing temperatures with water cannons for hours. We had to watch this for hours on social media with Facebook live streaming. They were just assaulting the people and, you know, shooting them with tear gas in a very confined space. They were on a bridge. The protectors, there were over 400 of them, were injured. They could not back up. They had to sit there and receive these canisters of tear gas in the face. Many of them were vomiting and peeing, relieving themselves spontaneously. And it was, but they would not trample each other because that was the only other option. This was not an action by the police done to simply disperse the people. This was torture, and that's why I say North Dakota has become a rogue state. It is not at all acting in any sort of manner we should expect a so-called democratic. It is acting as a full-on colony, and what you see visible there is military force, because when it's a tribe, when it's an indigenous nation demanding rights over territory and land that the U.S. is illegally occupying, then it becomes a very different matter, and it's faced with this kind of military force. If you compare it to the response of a NoDAPL protest in Iowa, which is primarily conducted by white citizens of the United States, it's a completely different response. But when it's done in conjunction with the land rights, the very strong legal under international law land rights that the great Sioux Nation, the Ocheti Shakuin, has, then it is an extreme threat, because it's a threat to the very integrity, the legitimacy of the state of North Dakota. Because a large amount of land in that state and in South Dakota is actually is occupied illegally and has been for over 150 years.
So get that question of unceded land and illegal occupation. You know, there's the pipeline, the route that they chose when they changed the route from near Bismarck is, you know, just north, right, of the reservation boundary.
Yes, it's within a mile of the reservation boundary.
Right, but that land, as you say, is unceded. So how did that land get removed from the tribe, from the reservation, from the nation?
Basically, they continue to. Of course, there was the discovery of gold in the Black Hills, which drove a lot of the breaking of the treaties and the incursions into our lands. And then it resulted with wars, what they call the Indian Wars, and then other treaties were signed, like the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie, which many people feel is a treaty that was ratified by the U.S. Senate. See, when these treaties are signed, they are the U.S. Senate ratifies them, which then recognizes the sovereignty of the Great Sioux Nation. Of course, we say our sovereignty certainly preexisted and doesn't require these treaties with the U.S., but this is legal proof under international law, and that we, were recognized by the United States as a sovereign nation. But the later treaty was not actually officially ratified by on our side, because it was done under duress and with basically at the point of a gun. And so the 1851 Treaty of Fort Laramie was done in a way that is much more accepted by both parties. And so basically they were just kept, forcing through military, you know, conquest. And I think that, you know, when you think of what the United States claims to be, you know, and you put that together with that, I think a lot of Americans, some Americans have a sense of triumphalism about that. You can see that with the what I call the Trumpeteers, the followers of Trump, and this sort of Trump America that is emerging and unmasking itself. You know, I think there is a part of the history of the United States which is about brutality, which is proud of that brutality. And certainly you can see that happening in North Dakota. And this is an occupation. You know, this is a de facto occupation of our lands. Some of the lands were later also taken in the 1940s and 50s during the development of the Pick Sloan dams up and down the Missouri River. There were dams put in and that basically targeted and only flooded native land. And many reservations were affected. In North Dakota, you have the Lake Sacajawea, which is on the Fort Berthold Reservation north of Bismarck. Then you also have the Lake Oahe, which is a man-made lake created with the damming of the river there at Standing Rock, which flooded hundreds of thousands of acres of Indian land, farmland. On my own reservation, on the Yankton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, you know, we have Lake Francis Case, which is there at Fort Randall, the Fort Randall Dam, and which flooded my own family's village of White Swan. You know, and of course, closer to the middle of South Dakota is another dam there near Fort Thompson. So all of these places were flooded, and our farms were put underwater. Over 2,000 Native farmers lost their farmland, and this is after forcing us onto reservations, forcing us to become farmers, and then they flooded our farms, the best farmland on the reservations. This is the river bottom land. This is like the best farmland.
This is a story of obviously that's repeated itself in similar and sometimes different ways across the country. I know there are dozens and dozens and dozens of examples. I know the San Carlos Apache tribe, that I was working with at one point on the Mount Graham telescope issue. They, you know, there were several areas on the borders, large areas that where they discovered copper that just got unilaterally by executive order. And, you know, these are stratagems. It's really difficult for people who don't really understand sort of the basis in federal Indian law, and it's really, you know, it's not that complex, but it's something you have to really study a little bit to understand. But you know, how does a president get the power to unilaterally alter a treaty that supposedly has, of course, some of the reservations were actually established by executive order. Anyway, this is complexity we can't get into now. But then
the issue with, from the U.S. side has always been about a cover up of its true actions, the true nature of its actions, and an assumption that Native people do not have that they treated with us, but at the same time they cited the doctrine of discovery as their right to have all of the land, and that citation happened in the 1830s. By the very first Chief Justice John Marshall of the Supreme Court. He was the first justice of a brand new country, and he had to devise legal sort of underpinnings for the taking of the land. And he basically turned to Roman Catholic law, papal law from the Vatican, and he found a papal bull that was, I think it was around the same time, that the New World was discovered.
1493,
yeah. Yeah, 1493. And was issued by the Pope. And basically, it was actually more to address the concerns between Portugal and Spain over who had rights. But and so that's why Brazil, he kind of drew a line, longitudinal line, and just said, this is where, you know. But he basically said that only Christian discovering nations have the right to the land. And when the minute that they touch the land, and then they do all those little things where they mark it with the flag and they say a little you know, thing, and then they, you kind of stamp a tree, burn something into a tree. At that point, then it becomes the all of that land, the title of the land, the fee simple title of the land reverts to the Christian discovering nation. And the indigenous people there who are not Christian basically only have the right to the land that the animals enjoy, which is that of occupancy and use. And so it was from the very beginning an idea that, and this is something I was explaining to a Time magazine reporter, you know, that there was never a notion of respect. You know, even when the King of England was granting charters and things to folks for colonies in on the East Coast in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania and Virginia. Many of these were granted to corporations like the Massachusetts Bay Company, you know, the Hudson Bay Company, the, you know, the East India Company, where they gave them India to a corporation. You know, these colonies were corporations. The U.S.'s origins are in corporations, you know, and not people. And so that is part of the true story of the myth of the origin story, which is not told to Americans, which is why America doesn't make any sense to Americans like Trumpeteers, who feel completely alienated because it was in fact not created for them and their benefit. And so those corporations that were granted to those colonies, when the colonies, the 13 original colonies, were trying to decide how they were going to. What they were going to do was they spread westward. Their goal with the Revolutionary War was to gain access to the Ohio Valley. The King George III had signed a treaty at the end of the French and Indian Wars and had basically promised that he would not allow the colonists to go into to Ohio, to those lands, those rich farmlands. And this really angered a lot of colonists, particularly wealthy ones like George Washington, who was a land speculator and had lands in the Ohio Valley that he wanted to exploit. And so this was part of their motivation, was expanding further west, which Great Britain was not interested in or England was not interested in, because that would make it harder for them to control the colonists. And also they had agreements that were international in nature, which kind of were different. You know, which anyway, so so they but the colonists, these different colonies like Virginia, they claim that their original charter meant that their land extended all the way to the Pacific Ocean, all the way across the continent. So you would imagine, so originally there wasn't this notion that they were going to create separate, you know, create new states as they went westward and took lands from indigenous people, from our nations. But they were going to actually just extend these original 13 colonies all the way across the continent. And so there is this notion that what was understood by the original and the founding of this, the coming of the colonizing of this continent was that it was complete domination. And so, so this is definitely a product of that. Even now today, the U.S. has actively erased the existence of sovereign nations within it. They suppress those nations. India's federal law is completely devised for that purpose. That's why we can't get a fair hearing in the Supreme Court, especially with it being so conservative. The whole purpose of the law is to sort of degrade, to mask, to give legal cover to the taking of the land.
So that was a long historical piece, extremely valuable. I hope people were paying good attention. This is you really set the stage for, you know, this, you, as you called it, a rogue state. But, you know, in a sense, states have often acted in ways, maybe it's getting to a point with the extreme corporate power that has been entrenched since the original establishment of the original corporations, aka colonies, but the corporations have basically become this sort of their own like super colonizing entity upon. These sort of vampires attached to vampires. Anyway, so we've got this North Dakota, which is acting in these ways completely contrary to the way that supposedly federal Indian law is even supposed to work, because supposedly Indian tribes, Native nations have a direct relationship to the federal government, and the states supposedly shouldn't. But the federal government isn't stepping in. You see, I know I've been. I don't know if it was you, or I heard the amazing Native author Jody Bird speak at Reed College. I think it might have been her talking about. She gave a whole talk about the invisibility of Native nations and how, you know, basically that, and you know, maybe you agree with this, or maybe, again, I heard it from you. I don't know that you know, African Americans, for whatever the actual results, you know, had a real national sort of crisis moment through the whole arc of the civil rights movement that really, you know, gripped, you know, the attention of the United States. And of course, they ended up being mixed results because of the imposition of the mass incarceration state and many other things that have kept them suppressed in general. But there hasn't really been a similar moment in a sense for Native Americans, even though, you know, the occupation of Wounded Knee garnered much attention. I don't know, this is maybe a kind of a forced analysis, but I just know that because talking to Native people over the years have felt, you know, just so invisibilized in this country, and that this was maybe finally the moment. And so maybe it's because this is that moment and people sense what's at stake that the suppression is so great.
Yeah. Well, it does go back to a question of what are states, you know, and states are creations of a colonial, a colony without portfolio. And it's only the state of North Dakota and the state of South Dakota is created out of, you know, illegally held lands of other people, you know, large swaths of it. And in the entire state of Nevada has never been ceded by the Shoshone, you know. It is all completely held by military force. And that is implicitly, I think, understood by most Americans. They often understand it under the guise of manifest destiny, of progress, how the West was won, these sorts of terms. But when you look at it on its face, it is about it's in opposition to everything the U.S. claims to stand for on the international scale. The absolute opposition. Its origins are in brutality, in, you know, in the taking, in the ignoring of the rule of law. You know, it's all a part of that. And so what I point out is that when Native nations stand up, it's far more threatening to the actual structure of colonialism because we have a claim to the land, and we have a claim that will that is actually, if looked at honestly, with clear eyes, without mythology, American mythology, it would destabilize the U.S., would delegitimize it, you know, not only internationally, not only with Native nations, but with its own people. And I think this Standing Rock is an opportunity for Americans to really look at who and what they are, who and what their country is, even who are their states. The states that they are members of, even very liberal states like Washington, Oregon, and California, which are starting to get a sense that they are going to be marginalized and under attack by a Trump administration running the federal government. And so I think that is the basic difference, is that when in his book, my grandmother's cousin, Vine Deloria Jr., wrote this book called Custer Died for Your Sins, that came out in 1969. And it was, you know, at the time it was a New York Times bestseller. One of the first times, I think maybe only times a Native person had a bestseller like that. A political treatise, you know, and he had a section on there sort of talking about the civil rights movement. He had been the executive director of the National Congress of American Indians in Washington, D.C. during the 60s and had dealt a lot between the tribes and the civil rights movement. And, you know, he really points out the basic difference is that African Americans, Black Americans were fighting for civil rights. And what indigenous people or Native nations, citizens of indigenous nations, First Nations, are fighting for is sovereignty, is a political recognition of who and what we are, you know. And that is you know, very different. But he also did suggest in the chapter that he felt that maybe Black Americans should demand sovereignty for protection purposes, where they could run their own area without being being harmed, being actively, kind of conspired against by white supremacy in America. And we've seen that conspiracy happen against Black Americans. I mean, you know, it's just, of course, the whole prison industrial complex directed at, harming Black people, Black citizens, and also, the whole mortgage crisis that happened recently, and just there's so many, and of course the schools, the resegregation of schools that has occurred in the last 20 years. So that is, once again, it is a difference between citizens in the U.S. having a statement, and nations that are suppressed within the U.S. that directly legitimize the U.S. is standing morally, democratically, in every sense.
And of course, then there's
I would point out that the state of North Dakota has so far not received federal funds for the military response that it's doing, but has borrowed $10 million from its own state bank. I mean, the state of North Dakota is the only state in the country that has its own bank. It's because of the Bakken oil, and they have borrowed $10 million from it in order to launch this incredible military response to a prayerful, protest, water protectors in Standing Rock. And last week, at that press conference, one of the law enforcement officials indicated that they fully expect to be reimbursed by the oil company. And that actually came out in some of the Unicorn Riots, been doing excellent on the ground journalism there. And they did a FOIA request, and they received emails also confirming that. But they expect to be paid by the oil company, Energy Transfer Partners, Sunoco, in Dallas, Texas. They are working for an oil company and doing this to protect an oil company. I was reading.
We need to get some callers in. We've gone 40 minutes and I haven't really opened it up. No, that's all right. It's important. The number is 503-231-8187. We already have one listener online. Harry, go ahead.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I have about three questions.
Well, let's see if we can get through one at a time.
Okay, the first one, with these violations of the treaties, the Fort Laramie treaties, can you take your complaints to the United Nations?
Yes, we have. And actually, there have been UN observers there. They already filed their report. We have a lot of support at that level, but we have, of course, the United States sits on the actual council at the UN, has veto power over anything that is passed or said and done at that level. The UN also has very little power to enforce what it says or does. The UN is, for about many decades, indigenous people were working at the UN and actually passed this thing called what we call UNDRIP, but it's the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And it's a really excellent document. I think that the U.S. finally agreed to sign it. There were only a few countries in the world that would not sign it, and that was, of course, colonies, Australia and the U.S. and Canada, these colonies that were developed under the Doctrine of Discovery.
So you don't see U.N. peacekeepers coming to North Dakota anytime soon?
I wish, but, the U.S. has veto power, and I think that we've been calling upon Obama and the Justice Department to step in. I actually got to meet with Wyden's office on Monday, and definitely there needs to be more oversight. They need to actually have a federal presence on the ground to observe and to watch and document what the Morton County Sheriff's Department is doing. The governor has declared a state of emergency. These state of emergencies were developed under post-Katrina to deal with emergencies. He's using it to call in other police departments from around the country to help with brutalizing water protectors. We need actual like federal presence on the ground to challenge and direct this. When they you know, these, it's just amazing. I mean, we've had dogs bite children. We've had, you know, this young woman is been in surgery last couple of days because they blew up a large chunk of her arm using a concussion grenade. They threw those right into the crowd. She claims, and many other water protectors claim that the police were directly throwing them, at their faces, and if they thought they were males, at their groins. Medics were directly attacked, right, you know, because they're wearing the Red Cross. These are all violations the Geneva Convention, you know, every kind of thing that the U.S. has been assigning to. This is outrageous, outrageous behavior.
So let's hear Harry's other question, then we got another listener. Go ahead, Harry.
Okay, my next question is what happened at Wounded Knee. The United States declared that the American Indian Movement was a terrorist organization. Is there another Native American movement, American Indian Movement, a Native American movement that people can support that's nationwide?
There was a sort of military wing of a camp called the Red Warrior Camp, but they have had a really problematic relationship with the community of Standing Rock and with the camp itself. They've actually been asked to leave the camp by the tribal council. That was the beginning of the month. The tribal council voted unanimously to ask them to leave, to great cheers from the community of Cannonball. So I would say support Standing Rock, support the actual tribe.
We got another caller to ask questions, but thank you. That's 2 out of 3 is not bad.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Jenny, go ahead. You're the next caller up.
Good morning. Thanks. Even in the context of the doctrine of discovery and sort of manifest destiny, and maybe even especially in the context of that, American Indians having sovereign nation status and the borders being set in some ways and in many others, like with regard to riparian water rights, not so much. Could these actions, torture, all of these things that are just, exemplary of 1960s Birmingham, Alabama, just terrible, terrible things, could they not, in the context of laws of sovereign nations, be considered acts of war?
The Cheyenne River Sioux tribal chairman, the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation is right, south of where the pipeline is being laid, and the Cheyenne River Sioux Indian Reservation is right south of it, adjacent to it. These are the two largest extant pieces of land left to the Great Sioux Nation. They are the size of Israel or El Salvador. They're substantial native populations and communities downriver. The Cheyenne River Sioux tribal chairman issued a letter just the other day, demanding that, saying that these are acts of war, and that he wrote to the Department of the Interior, ironically, Native nations are under the Department of Interior rather than any kind of where they should be, the Secretary of State's office, and demanded that all of the North Dakota law enforcement be removed from 1851 treaty territory, because these are acts of war that they are committing, and it's a breaking of the treaty, and that they are continuing and revitalizing hostilities against the Great Sioux Nation.
Wow. Really, really important information to have out there. Thank you so much, and we'll continue to follow all of this. I'll give somebody else a chance to talk. Thank you so much.
So anybody else want to call in? The number is 503-231-8187. The lines are open. So I had a question just about, because I know there's talk about mobilizing the National Guard against the protesters, but if you think of the National Guard in the context of previous mass struggles by internally colonized people, the African Americans during the, the so-called civil rights movement, that they were mobilized to actually protect, like, I believe, you know, university students going to desegregated schools and to protect, you know, against the, you know, once it became too public, too present in the mass media and the popular mind, the viciousness of the suppression of that movement, that National Guard. So yeah. Who has control over the National Guard?
Right. You know, the National Guard has already been called in by the governor. It's under the state.
But doesn't can it get preempted by the executive
branch?
Well,
that's what we were hoping that Obama would be to federalize the National Guard in North Dakota. But the National Guard in North Dakota has been actively part of this, maybe not on the front lines, but definitely running all the roadblocks. The reason why what happened on Sunday happened is because the North Dakota has maintained a roadblock there for a month now, and that highway is the main highway that Standing Rock residents reach Bismarck to go shopping. It's also a form of economic sanctions against the tribe because you know, people can't come to their casino; they have to take a 40-minute detour around the highway.
And apparently that truck that was on that bridge that prevented the ambulances getting through there, and that took 8 hours for that poor woman to...
Well, she actually had the EMT, the emergency response team from the reservation, from Standing Rock and Cheyenne River, were the ones who came up to help the people. And then she had to be flown out from the Indian Health Service. And so it is, there is a serious, I was talking at the White and Whiten's office, there was a doctor there who then just asked Daniel Rock, he's a member of the Physicians for Social Responsibility here in Oregon. And he was saying that, you know, he had dealt with, folks he was caring for that, you know, it took hours for them to get an ambulance there, to take them to get health care. I mean, there were elders on the lines who were shot with, who were shot with on the front lines that night, who had went under cardiac arrest. You know, I mean, this is a serious health issue, not having this blockade for this long, and it's done as an act of war against the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. So, and that's why they were trying to move one of the burned out vehicles as an act of to be nice. That's what the water projectors were doing, to try to de-escalate the situation and remove them. And that's why they were attacked on Sunday night.
And of course, go ahead.
Yeah. And I also like to draw the line between colonialism, the extreme extraction of resources for quick wealth by another country from another country, to the whole climate change issue. I mean, the colonies of the United States and other countries and Canada are, you know, prime movers in this sort of international concept of quick money, of quick wealth, of the system we live in today. And climate change and the harms from it are directly tied to the attitudes of a colony. And that is, so by attacking colonialism, decolonizing, you are attacking climate change.
So we have a caller. Let's wait till... our engineer gets back at the board there. So Spring is on the air now. Go ahead.
Thank you. Yes, I'm not online, and KBOO is my lifeline, and shows such as this. Thank you so much. I want an address to send some money to Standing Rock.
Go to their website, Standing Rock.
I'm not online.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry.
That's the thing.
That was what you said.
So I just need a physical address to send some funds. I've been dying to do this, and I keep forgetting to ask people online to let me go or whatever. So that's what I need.
Do you have one right at hand, Jacqueline?
Let me see here.
Huh.
Can you get her number?
Could you leave your number with the
sure.
We'll let you go now, and Liam will.
Thank you, Jacqueline.
Okay, Liam, could you pick up and get her number? Yeah, thank you. Okay, let's go to.
For people who are online, I would definitely suggest checking out the tribe's website, standwithstandingrock.net. So,
okay.
Standwithstandingrock.net. It has a lot of information on it, and there. I've been meaning to put together a blog on my. Tiershvaya now about all the places that I really recommend, that I know are good to give to There are a lot of, I hate to say this, but this has kind of become like a Haiti situation where you have a lot of people raising money and it's not going to where they say it's going. So I should put it together, that blog, and kind of give people a general sense of where it's a good place to give money. It will actually go to the actual camp. There's been some problems with that.
And I will make every attempt to, again, for those people who are online, unfortunately, so much happens that way these days. It's a double-edged sword. KBOO.FM, Wednesday Talk Radio. I will do my best to put up some of the basic links on there. So we have another caller. Stacy, I believe, is up next. Hello, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm not sure that any more words can say enough for the people that are there at Standing Rock. I have a suggestion for everybody, though, since we may not be able to go or anything, maybe if you could just make a sign that says something in support of Standing Rock, or go out there with a, you know, put a yard sign, anything at all, so all of the other people will have to be addressing that situation, because I know the news isn't.
Okay. Well, thank you for that.
Thank you.
And I got an article. Veterans are planning a deployment to Standing Rock to protest the Dakota Access Pipeline. I thought that this was really interesting. Wes Clark Jr., the son of the famous general, is one of the most vociferous opponents of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And he's putting together, and there's actually a group, Veterans Stand for Standing Rock. So if there are any veterans out there who haven't heard of this yet, this is a possible way for you to plug in. Just a few other things from the Sunday night, a list of injuries. This is a statement prepared by Standing Rock Medic and Healer Council at the Standing Rock Dakota Access Pipeline Resistance Camps. An elder lost consciousness and was revived on scene. A young man had a grand mal seizure. A woman shot in the face by a rubber bullet with subsequent eye injury and compromised vision. A young man with internal bleeding who was vomiting blood after rubber bullet injury in his abdomen. A man shot in the back near his spine by a rubber bullet causing blunt force trauma and a severe head laceration. Multiple fractures secondary to projectiles fired by police, and many other. It's a gruesome situation for, as Jacqueline said, for hours being sprayed by a fire hose in the cold weather there. People taking it. I'm just amazed that just people are just being able to send wave after wave at this occupation force. It's truly an amazing thing. But I just wanted to let you know what's coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspective. Students from Portland State University and inmates from McLaren Youth Correctional Facility come together to learn about the role of music in social change. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, it's Flashpoints, a look at the future of public school education under a Trump presidency. Also, what kind of attorney general will a white supremacist like Jefferson Sessions make? At 11 on the Recovery Zone, author Susan Engel discusses her recent book, The End of the Rainbow, How Educating for Happiness, Not Money, Would Transform Our Schools. And thank all of you for continuing to support this radio station. If you are not yet and would like to become a member, go to KBOO.FM and click on donate. We only have about 5 minutes left. We've got one more caller I think we can bring into the conversation. Nikki, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say that I'm blessed to share that I have a friend that is retired, and she bought a Winnebago with the money that came her way, and she's heading to Standing Rock indefinitely, and she has room in her trailer to, she's collecting wool blankets, all kinds of warm clothes, hats, scarves, everything that the people that are there might be able to use, and firewood. So I can leave my number with Liam, I believe, and if people want to donate things like that, she can take it out there directly.
Okay. We'll try to figure out if... great. So, Liam, you heard that. If you could get the number of... I'm sorry, what was your name again? Nikki.
Yeah, just, I know there's a lot of people that don't have much to give, but every little bit will matter, and people might have some extra warm blankets and such to donate to the people there.
Okay, well, thank you for that. So,
yeah,
Liam, if you could get Nikki's number also. Okay. And thank you for calling. So, Jacqueline, we didn't get to talk about this grand idea of an indigenous-led popular front, but I think, you know, people may be getting the idea that, you know, indeed, not only, you know, do indigenous people have a lot to offer culturally and in terms of just an example of resiliency and resistance, sort of the idea of the, you know, the environmental Native American has both its sort of romantic and its very real aspect, obviously. But now we're seeing that Native Americans are actually, you know, on the front lines of, you know, fighting all these battles that all of us want to see gain some traction, like stopping coal export terminals, stopping Nestle here in the Gorge, where it's been very difficult to stop Nestle Corporation from stealing our water everywhere in this country and around the world. We see certainly at Standing Rock just a incredibly gutsy and really risky, from if you look at the extent that Native nations are you know, under the financial thumb often of the federal government. So these stands are not without potential consequences.
Yeah, and I don't think that the arrival of the Trump presidency and his backing of the outrageous tactics of North Dakota, the rogue state of North Dakota, is going to stop the tribe. I mean, I think the Standing Rock Sioux Nation has taken a stand, and it could lead to some really, I mean, North Dakota's outrageous behavior could lead to some really, really terrible things. And right now we have no federal presence standing up and holding them accountable. And it's really, really scary. And I think that the tribes will not stand down. You see, when you go to the main camp there, that you will see hundreds of flags from tribes because this is a sovereignty issue, you know, and the tribes are not going to back down. I mean, they are, I think backing down would mean death for the tribes. It would mean saying that anything can be done to their people. And so this isn't going to go away, even with greater brutality. I think that it's a chance for people to register their concerns about this kind of America, Trump's America, which is, to an extent, our historical America. You know, we try to tell ourselves that it's not like this, but the very foundations of this country are about this. You know, and when foundations matter, origin stories matter, where you're really from matters. If you're a part of a colony that's exploiting other people, it matters. It's time for Americans to wake up and to be really aware of that.
All right. Well, Walter wanted a really quick comment here. Is he still there, Liam? Walter? No, he's gone.
Hello?
Okay, go ahead, really quick.
Okay, I'm just wondering where the president is. I mean, it's all this nice language. Oh, we'll just see how it plays out. Well, we're seeing how it's going to play out. So where is he? That's my question.
Jacqueline, quickly.
I have the same question. Very, very. I mean, we've been asking him for months now, and now it's like, what, the last, you know, several weeks of his, you know, of his administration. Where is he? I mean, his last interview earlier this month, he said that he was going to let it play out a few weeks. Well, in that time, many people have been injured. You know, hundreds of people have been injured. I think they estimated the first night, 100 of the medics, 160, you know, were injured in hypothermia. I mean, this is just completely reckless behavior by the state of North Dakota, and no one is holding them accountable. And it is outrageous. And if this was happening anywhere else in the country, and your Reverend Jesse Jackson went to Standing Rock and he said, we never faced this at Ferguson. This is worse. This is worse on every level. You know, this is what happens when Native nations stand up, because we have title to the land and to its resources. And that is the ultimate threatening thing to a colony.
Okay. Well, that's the last note we're in. And thank you so much again, Jacqueline. And we'll talk to you again. And this has been Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland Community Radio.
Indian legislation's on the desk of a do-right congressman. Now, he don't know much about the issue, so he picks up the phone and he asks advice of the senator out in Indian country, a darling of the energy companies who are ripping off what's left of the reservations. I learned a safety rule. Corporate bank, they'll send in federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality. Bury my heart in wounded knee. Deep in the earth.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the third annual Flash Holiday Show, running December 8th through 11th at the Alberta Abbey in Portland. Based on the 80s cult classic film Flash Gordon, Flash is Portland's premier rock opera parody, complete with a live rock band, Mercury Rising, formed at the School of Rock. Again, that's the third annual Flash Holiday Show, running December 8th through 11th at the Alberta Abbey, 126 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934